Joe, is your house paid in cash? Do you still have a mortgage on it? What's your deal?
We have a mortgage, but it's such a low interest rate. Interest rates were through the floor. So it's 2.75%.
Nice. Do you have a lot of equity in your home?
For an interest rate that was that low, we borrowed more. But the answer is a fair amount. Why do you ask, Paula?
Well, I'm asking because the first question that we're going to be addressing today is from a woman who has a lot of home equity and doesn't like the fact that it's just sitting there not making any money. So we're going to answer that plus several more questions.
I thought you were just crying.
I know, right? Welcome to the Afford Anything podcast, the show that understands you can afford anything, but not everything. Every choice that you make carries a trade-off, which means the equity that you hold in your home is a wealth on your balance sheet that you're not spending elsewhere. So what are the trade-offs that you're willing to make? And how do you execute on those decisions? That is a lifetime practice, and that's what this podcast is here to explore and facilitate. I'm Paula Pant. I am the host of this podcast. And every other week, my buddy, Joe Salcihi, the former financial planner, joins me to help answer questions. What's up, Joe?
Well, I'm here. I'm reporting for duty, and I'm excited.
Fantastic. Let's just dive right in. Our first question comes from Lindy.
Hi, Paula. Hi, Joe. I appreciate all your hard work. My question is, I've got a rental house with about $300,000 in equity just sitting there. And I feel like I'm missing out. I'm just frozen. I'm sitting on the sidelines. I've done fix and flips before, but I'm not excited about buying houses right now. But I feel like I'm missing out on opportunities with this money just sitting there. Is there any ideas that you guys have where I can put this money where it's still building assets or ideally creating a little bit of cash flow? Or is the best option to just like keep letting it sit there? Thank you so much.
Lindy, that's a great question. And I think that your question is something that a lot of homeowners are feeling right now. If you purchased your home a few years ago, you may have a lot of accumulated equity. Like Lindy, you've got $300,000. And that is, as you rightly point out, wealth that is on your balance sheet, but it isn't overtly making any money. It is in the sense that your equity will rise at the rate of general market appreciation. But beyond that, there is this sense, this FOMO that comes from thinking, wait a minute, I could pull that money out and use it to do something else, but should I?
You think about Paula, it's even worse because this is not her primary residence where I could see that, but being a little conservative. But I think it's also for Lindy, the fact that it's in an investment property. And so the investment property is only going up, to your point, at the rate of appreciation. And you know what I mean? So if it's an investment that's sitting there in something super conservative, it's even worse than if it's your primary residence.
Right. But then the decision as to whether or not you should pull that money out comes down to really two things. One is the level of risk that you're willing to take, and the other is the arbitrage. And so we'll start with the risk. Lindy, I'm saying this not for you, but just for all people who are listening. If you have a particular property and you don't want to risk losing that property, maybe you have a particular property that has a strong emotional significance for you. So for example, maybe you have a property that's technically a rental property. You know, you're not living in it, you're renting it out, but it was your grandma's house, right? And it has a lot of emotional significance and you don't want to risk the possibility of losing it. Then I would say, you know, never put up for collateral something that you're willing to lose. And when you borrow against a home, when you borrow against the equity in a home, you are putting that home up for collateral. You are securitizing debt with that home. And so if there's a particular property that has that for emotional reasons you would never want to lose, then don't risk it. But Lindy, in your case, it sounds like that's not the deal with this property. So then it becomes very much an arbitrage decision. If you were to borrow against that equity right now, you would be paying a pretty high interest rate for the sake of borrowing against that equity. So is there an investment that you could undertake that would have a high enough return, there would be a big enough spread to justify taking out a high enough such a high interest rate? I don't know how many opportunities there are that would give you a big enough spread.
I think it's so difficult. You look at you look at the usual opportunities, Paula, that you tell people to start off with. And because of the high interest rate, you got to land where Lindy is. I mean, when I go through what seems like what a good use of that money would be, it's my least favorite option. It's one of my least favorite options in real estate, which is a flip. But a flip is like buying a job.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're going to be working full time quickly because you got to flip that house fast if mm-hmm. you're going to make the money work. So to get that working in a higher interest rate environment, a flip becomes your best friend. But there's all the negatives around that. So I'm reticent to tell Lindy, yeah, go take that money out and use it to flip a different yuck. I mean, and not yuck for everybody. You know what I mean? Not yuck for everybody, because there's a certain investor that really likes that. It is a full-time job for them and they enjoy it. And that's great. But I can't, you know, you can't paint that broad stroke.
You know, in Lindy's case, I think flipping could be a good idea because she's done fix and flips before. So she has the experience. She knows what goes into all the work and the costs that go into doing a fix and flip.
And the need to do it fast.
Right, exactly. I think a flip would be probably the use. It would be one of two uses of that money that I can think of. Well, one of three, actually, that I can think of that might have a high enough spread. But I say that for Lindy only because she has experience in the past. And she would have to know going into it that this is going to be, as you say, Joe, a full-time job. So that's one of three use cases. The second would be on the subject of a full-time job. If she runs some type of a business, and if that business needs money for not for day-to-day operational expenses, I'm a proponent that you shouldn't borrow to cover your ongoing operational costs, but if that business needs to borrow in order to buy some CapEx, for example, that could really help it expand. Okay, I can see a case there because any business that you are running as a full-time enterprise, right, that can yield some pretty significant returns. That would be the second use case. Now, the third case would be if she were to use this money to buy a rental property. And if she were to do that, this is different than simply taking out another mortgage, because if she were to do that, she would be still paying her current mortgage on this particular property. But she would also then have a second loan on this property where she's borrowing even more. So she's stacking interest there. That makes this very different than somebody who is brand new to rental property investing. They're buying a property fresh for the first time and they're getting just one loan on one house, right? Taking out two loans and subjecting your first rental to a bunch of risk because you want that second one to work out, you're stacking the dominoes mm-hmm. in a way that you're not when you're just taking out a loan fresh. That's the reason why borrowing against this property to buy another rental is, for her, it's going to be very different than if she were to just go to a bank and take out a fresh loan for a rental. Those are different risk profiles, different loan scenarios.
One of my favorite quotes in investing, Paula, and there's a bunch of them out there, but this one I particularly like, and I'll apologize people that aren't sports fans because it's a baseball reference, but Warren mm-hmm. Buffett said that in investing, there's no such thing as a called strike. And in baseball, what happens is if the pitcher throws the pitch, people who don't know baseball, and you don't swing, it can be really bad if you don't swing, right? Because they will call it a strike. The ball goes right down the middle and you don't swing, they will make it really bad for you. So you got to swing the bat. What Warren Buffett's alluding to is you don't have to do anything that is not in your best interest. And here's what I like. You and I don't like to play the crystal ball game. I definitely don't like to predict the future, but I can predict this, Paula, because I know these things to be true. I know, number one, that people have adjustable rate mortgages. And I do know that some of those interest rates are at a low mortgage like mine. Now, mine's a fixed rate loan, right? That it's a very low interest rate. But there are people with adjustable rate mortgages that rolled the dice and they are sitting on these loans that in the next few years are going to have to be redone. Those loans are going to be redone at higher rates. I also know there are constantly people doing stupid things like mortgaging themselves to the hilt. So I think, like a lot of people think, that there may be opportunity. I don't know if it's going to be a lot of opportunities or only a few opportunities, But I do know that there should be some fairly juicy ones coming where you have motivated sellers who just got to get out of this property before the bank takes it back. I think there's going to be some of that coming down the road. If that is true, and I don't think I'm looking really into the crystal ball as much as I am just thinking through, you used the word dominoes earlier, of what happens when interest rates go up. I like having this ready for a potential deal that does make sense. I think what Lindy's got to do first is figure out what the parameters are of what actually makes sense for her. What does that deal look like that makes sense? And do that little bit of math so that when it approaches and it actually happens and appears on her radar, she can then move very quickly. I don't mind having this sitting waiting for a better deal. I feel like sometimes we try to create deals where there are none. Because of our, I don't know if it's FOMO or what.
Right. Or we try to deploy cash as quickly as we can because we don't like cash sitting on the sidelines. But in times of opportunity, those who are sitting on cash are the ones who are able to take advantage of that opportunity. You know, Lindy, a way to reframe it, rather than thinking, hey, I've got this equity and it's just sitting there, not making any money other than market appreciation on the property. The reframe of that is, hey, I have this like bucket of opportunity, right? And I don't have to do anything with it. I can let it sit there. I can wait for as long as it takes. And then when a great opportunity appears, if the opportunity is so good, I can then use it. So fundamentally, that reframe shuffles, I don't want to say cause and effect, but it shuffles what the first step and the second, right? Rather than I have money, therefore I should deploy it. Take that off the table. Instead, it's if I find a great opportunity, then I know that I have a resource I can tap. But if I don't find a great opportunity, then I don't have to tap that resource. I can let that resource continue to rise at the rate of market appreciation.
I love that because what it also alludes to is we being Lindy, I won't be in on that discussion most probably, but she needs to define for herself what great opportunity means. What does that actually mean? So again, beginning with the end in mind, what rate of return does she need to reach her end goal, her end game, whatever that goal is? And then that gives her a structure in which to decide that this truly is a great opportunity for me. Because an opportunity for you, Paula, that's great, maybe something completely different for me.
Right, right. And, you know, the fact that she has mentioned her history with fix and flips in the past makes me wonder if for Lindy, perhaps the opportunity might come in the form of finding a dilapidated property in a great neighborhood, right? Find the worst house on the block. And, you know, if she has the connections, if she has the experience of flipping, then perhaps she could do a flip.
And that's an example of great for her, not great for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. The other good thing about using this money to do a flip is that if she were to take out, let's say, a HELOC on this, she would only need to be borrowing against that equity for a very short period of time. Unlike buying a rental property where you've got a long-term mortgage now, if she took out a HELOC, she could use it for 6 months, pay it back. And if she did that once a year, you know, one flip a year, yeah, it's a decent use of that capital. But Lindy, I think the thinking framework isn't, I have money, therefore I should spend it. It's, I search for opportunity and know that I'm capable of capitalizing on that opportunity if it appears.
You allude to something tactical there too, Paula, mm-hmm. which is, you know, we talked about being able to move quickly when the right deal appears, making sure she has that HELOC ready to go. Like she doesn't want to have to take that out later. If she knows that this money is money she's going to want to deploy, there might be a fee every year to keep the HELOC open and not use it. But certainly for somebody like her who's waiting to deploy it, I would call that a small cost of insurance to be able to write a very quick check to get that stuff moving versus I see an opportunity, I go to my bank, you know how long a bank can take. I mean, that can drive you crazy. So I definitely prefer to get that open now and have it ready to go.
But more broadly, Joe, when you were a financial planner, when people would come to you, I want to take this conversation away from real estate and kind of open this up. When people would come to you and say, hey, I have a bunch of cash that is, or I have a bunch of, I have assets that are relatively illiquid, but I don't feel as though they're performing as well as they otherwise could be. And I want to make better use of them, or I'm feeling FOMO at the fact that I'm not making better use of them. What would be your general approach to that?
So the general approach starts with, we need to get away from phrasing like not working as well as it could be, because that implies that there is a perfect way for those assets to be used. And if we go to what is the perfect use of an asset, we know what the goal is that we're shooting for. We're investing it into an investment that shares a propensity for winning with that timeline, meaning if it's over 15 years, stocks and real estate are fantastic. If it's a one-year goal, then generally, not talking about flipping, which is much more of a job, but more of a passive investment, is going to be something, you know, a savings account, a money market is a much better place. A CD is a better place where you have a propensity of winning. I start with that. But then I also start with a bias toward behavior versus statistics. So let me explain that. Statistically, having a low interest rate mortgage like I have now is a winning position, because I can do all kinds of fun arbitrage tricks, right? I can pay a little bit on that mortgage every month, and then I can invest my money elsewhere. That's the game that I'm playing. Generally, I know though, Paula, I try not to play that game. That rate was just too low for me to not play. A recent study showed that the average retiree is happier if they don't have a mortgage. And people are generally happier if they don't have debt. So my bias is against debt, not because I won't play the arbitrage game, but because generally people are happier when they don't have it. So if that's the case, I will try to stay away from debt and debt instruments if at all possible.
And I think there's a lot to be said for tearing away from the framework of this money could be working harder, which is, it's almost as though what you learn as a beginner in the world of personal finance is at odds with what you need to embrace when you're a bit more intermediate or advanced. As a beginner, when people are first coming to the world of personal finance, they've never thought of the notion that your money could be working for you. And so teaching people, hey, you don't just have to trade your own time for money. Your money can also make money. That basic foundational concept is great for beginners. But once you're a bit more advanced in the world of personal finance, you then almost have to not unlearn that, but put some additional nuance on that, because it isn't the case that if some is good, more is better. It's more the case that you don't want to take on more risk than you have to in order to get the returns that you are shooting for, in order to live the life that you want to live. So, you know, how much risk do you need to take? How much leverage, if any, do you want to take on? How much of your current success do you want to put up as collateral for the sake of reaching that next tier? At a certain point, you might say, you know what? The success that I have already achieved, I'm good with it, or I'm good with slow rolling it from here on out. And I don't want to put up what I've already built as collateral in order to get to that next tier.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. This is a little scary to say, but you sound exactly like Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank, who calls himself Mr. Wonderful. He was talking about, Paula, and he used some pretty wild mm-hmm. terms. He talked about how, well, you need a cushion of $5 million. Now, mm-hmm. that's where he starts. But hear this for what it really is. Make sure that that is secure. And after that, then it's very easy to take money out and deploy it into crazy things that are opportunities that really can spur you ahead, because you know you're going to be okay. So if we back away from his $5 million mark, what is he saying? He's saying really what you're saying, which is have this money that is toward your goals to go where you want to go. And then beyond that, what do I want to do? What creative stuff can I do?
Right. Essentially build the base, secure the foundation, don't risk the foundation. And then anything above and beyond that foundation, that is subject to risk, but not the foundation itself. So Lindy, I hope that gives you some additional context for how you should think through A, whether or not you want to borrow against this equity, and B, if so, what type of opportunities would be worthwhile? So thank you for the question, Lindy.
We'll come back to this episode after this word from our sponsors.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Like your hair, your net worth, I hope. Your income, your investment portfolio. Again, I hope. Hey, how about the revenue in the business that you run on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, whether you just started or whether you've been in business for 10 years, whether you're selling accounting textbooks or windshield wiper repair kits, and whether you're selling in person or online. If you're online, know that Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can leverage AI with Shopify Magic, an AI-powered all-star. Now, what I like about Shopify is that it's there for you whether you are just beginning or whether you are doing your first million in revenue, your first dollar to your first million plus. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. They have award-winning help. And businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. So, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Paula, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Paula now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Paula. Still searching for a great candidate for your company? Don't search, just match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. And 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. When I hire people, it's typically because we already have more work than we can handle, which is why we are looking to expand our team. But hiring is additional workload on top of an already overloaded plate. So you need a matching engine that is both fast and high quality. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses around the world that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Paula. Just go to Indeed.com/Paula right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Paula. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. When it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I didn't know how to optimize what was in my wallet, so I didn't know how to optimize how to use travel rewards to pay for vacations. But now I've got a new card with more miles, and I'm getting business class upgrades, I'm getting lounge access, I'm getting all kinds of perks that I didn't even know that I was missing out on. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access, wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval, and terms of each credit card issuer apply. Our next question comes from Katie.
Hi, Paula and Joe. My name is Katie, and I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller. Thank you so much for your work. My spouse and I have learned a ton over the years because of Afford Anything. My question is about accepting Section 8 housing vouchers for a rental property. Specifically, what should my spouse and I be thinking about when considering participating as a landlord in this program? To provide some context, my spouse and I are originally from the U.S., but now live and work overseas with employer-provided housing at no cost to us. We currently don't own any property in the U.S., but plan to retire in my home state in about 18 years. We want to buy a home, rent it out while we live abroad, and likely live in it once we retire. We're also concerned about the impact redlining has had on the city we plan to buy in, and want to ensure we provide a fair housing opportunity to potential renters. From my research, it seems like one way to do this is through Section 8, but many landlords don't seem to opt into the program. Any insight into pursuing Section 8 or similar programs is appreciated. Thank you, and have a great day.
Katie, I love the question. So first of all, congratulations on having such a clear plan and on caring so much about your community and wanting to make sure that you are doing what is best, not only for yourself, but also for your community. So let's talk through both of these concepts. And I'm going to talk about each one separately because the link between, you know, within your question, you ask if there is an established link between the problem of redlining and the potential solution of Section 8. But let's talk about each idea separately. So first of all, I know many landlords who participate in Section 8. I even myself considered putting one of my properties, one specific property, on Section 8. The advantages, as I'm sure you already know, are that you have a certain percentage of your rent that is guaranteed, right? And so you know that you're able to count on that. The disadvantages are that you have to follow the Section 8's guidelines in terms of exactly how much you can charge. You have to follow the Section 8 inspector on precisely the quality and the repairs and maintenance of the property. And on the surface, those don't sound like big deals. But, you know, I've heard stories from investors where, for example, they might have a very, very old home with historic windows, but one of those windows has like a tiny little chip in it. The Section 8 inspector says, well, you can't have a cracked window, so you need to take out these 100-year-old wood historic windows and put in, right? Yeah. So things like that, where the code is not written in a way that takes into account the nuance or the character of a particular home, you know, and then you're like taking out these historic wood windows that are on a pulley system, right? Like that, it removes the character from the home. It removes the character. It actually makes the home and by extension, the neighborhood a little bit worse, but this is what the program requires me to do. So little things like that, I've heard landlords complain about. The bigger thing administratively is that every I needs to be dotted, every T needs to be crossed. It's a lot of paperwork. So you need to be the type of person who can really be on top of a user-unfriendly, highly bureaucratic, very paperwork-intensive administrative process. The other thing about it is there are certain areas where you can have Section 8 properties and certain areas where your municipality won't let you have a Section 8 property there. So the home that you are looking for would need to be in a Section 8 zone. And that goes to the other piece of your question, which is about redlining. So Habitat for Humanity has a great page, and I'm going to link to this in the show notes, about solutions to advance racial equity in housing. And one of those, it's a very long, I'm going to link to this in the show notes because they have a lot of policy related suggestions. But one of those is reforming zoning to allow for mixed income communities. And that's actually something I feel quite strongly about because that also plays into the housing shortage. The fact that zoning laws often do not allow for mixed income communities and often do not allow for multifamily housing in communities where there are a lot of single family homes, that simultaneously contributes to the housing shortage because now you can't build multifamily, so you can't have more units, more density, right? So it simultaneously contributes to the housing shortage as well as contributes to redlining. So that rezoning at a policy level is, you know, I think very important, not just for redlining, but for housing affordability generally. That's the type of thing where, you know, those decisions are made at the local level and you need involvement at the local level to try to push for the type of zoning that would allow that. And maybe I don't know what town you want to invest in. Maybe your town already has zoning that allows for mixed income communities and already has zoning that allows for the construction of multi-unit properties in single-family neighborhoods, right? If so, that's fantastic. We need more multifamily, and that means more mixed-income communities.
Paul, I love where your discussion of this is going, because I always begin with, what are my controllables? What can I do? I recently spoke to a gentleman, Dr. Seth Kaplan, who has a book out called Fragile Neighborhoods. And he talks about how the State Department would go to countries that have very unstable governments or fragile systems, such as one that he points to is Egypt as an example, where it's fairly fragile and new. He said, even though the top layers of government might be fragile, neighborhoods that he went into were often rock solid. And the U.S. in many ways is the flip of that. We don't talk to our neighbor. We spend all day online. We don't have this neighborhood. And what he talked about when I asked him about many people in the real estate community, what do you do? He focused on intent and working horizontally with people in that neighborhood. And so I don't know that the answer is in Section 8 or non-Section 8, because even listening to you talk about that, that discussion gets well beyond anything that you can truly control. But what you can control is your intent to be a help to the community, which means joining a neighborhood, listening to neighborhood leaders, inserting yourself in this neighborhood, and then using your unique ability to do real estate and make homes for people in that better, and to help build the neighborhood as a positive. And I would begin there before I think about whether Section 8 is going to fit or not fit. I thought his discussion of that, of being a part of the neighborhood, was wonderful. And if anybody gets the chance to read that book, it's really flips a lot of things on their head. I believe after talking to this guy, and I'm a guy who's, you know, like you, Paula, we talk to tons of people. I believe that a lot of our ills can be solved if we involve ourselves more in our hyper-local neighborhood.
Right, exactly. And hyperlocal is where you have the greatest ability to make the biggest impact. So getting involved in those neighborhood associations, getting involved in, you know, it's funny when we have elections, we talk so much about what's happening at the national level. We talk very little about what's happening at the hyperlocal level, right? But hyperlocal is where big changes can be made.
This guy even talked about elections. In fact, Dr. Kaplan told me, he said, you know, Joe, you can take two people diametrically opposed when it comes to politics, and you tell them, you go, okay, let's sit down and let's just talk it out. He said, by the end of half an hour, they're yelling louder than ever, right? But you give them a shovel ready project to build a community garden together, they're best friends. They are best friends because we're working on something that we both can agree on, which is that garden needs to be in our backyard.
Exactly. Or more density. We need 1,000 more units of housing within this zip code.
Yes. And right? They can both agree, regardless of who's going to be the next president.
Right. Exactly. And so then when you're like, all right, how do we solve this very specific problem? How do we get 1,000 more units of housing in this zip code?
The other exciting piece of this, Paula, that I liked was he also pointed out that once neighborhood leaders know you and they trust you and they trust your intent, because in many neighborhoods that need help, they've seen so many real estate investors that have just done the wrong thing for the neighborhood and they are part of the problem. Once they know you're part of the solution, you also may get an increased access to deals, because the community leaders are bringing, hey, we need help on this block. We need help with this thing. We need somebody we can trust that can go in and has access to resources, the ability to, in systems to help people get housing where they most need it. Once people trust you, all of a sudden, some of these deals that are done in back rooms places, you're a part of them. Mm-hmm. You are a part of them, right? because the powers that be want to see you succeed, because they know you want to see them succeed.
Right. You know, when some of the most successful single family residence investors in Atlanta that I saw, their strategy was that they bought as many homes as they could on one particular street, and they just invested everything into making this an amazing street, right? So they might have 5 or 6 single family homes on this one particular street, but they're very aware of everything that goes on that street. That particular street is their expertise, And that particular street is where they put their effort when it comes to improving the community, you know, making it a better, safer, more inclusive, happier place for everybody. Yeah, and that also became their competitive advantage when the big hedge funds started buying up a bunch of properties, right?
Right.
When Wall Street algorithms started buying a bunch of properties, the competitive advantage of the local mom and pop investor, of the individual investor, is hyper-local knowledge. And that is something that no hedge fund that is making algorithm-based decisions could ever have.
It's so exciting. I mean, listen to the pace of the cadence of our discussion once we got into what we can control. And I think control it for good. I mean, for good for everybody. It's so exciting.
Katie, thank you for asking that question. I'm really looking forward to hearing back from you, hopefully, to learn about the property that you buy and the neighborhood that you start really involving yourself in.
We'll come back to the show in just a second, but first...
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Joe, we have one more question today.
Only one?
Yes, one more question. It's actually the opposite of hyperlocal investing. This is about international investing.
Ooh.
This question comes from Claudia.
Hello, Paula. This is Claudia from Hamburg, Germany. I need a little advice because I want to buy an apartment in New York for myself. I'm German. I'm 56 years old. I have two rental properties here in Hamburg. I'm working as a police officer fraud. I studied law, so I'm a lawyer and working at the police fraud investigations. And I do properties and real estate investing in the second generation. And I like to renovate also homes or flats. Now, I saw a flat in Manhattan Upper West at Zillow for $160,000, which I can pay. But the thing is that there are a lot of differences, what it seems to me, between the German rental laws and maybe the property laws. I'm not sure about that. So I need some help and some advice for this specific flat in New York City, Manhattan. Maybe you can help me. That would be too nice. Thank you very much for your work and for all the work in the community. I very much enjoy all your podcasts and the whole community. Thank you very much. Goodbye from Hamburg, Germany.
That's fabulous.
Yes. Claudia, thank you for the question. I love the question. Joe, I saw you nodding when she talked about how the laws in Germany, laws related to property ownership, taxes, every procedural component of it is very different than it is in the United States.
I was nodding, Claudia, because it's not only different between Germany and Manhattan. I'm in Texarkana, Texas, and I know that Manhattan has very specific rules and rent controls. Mm-hmm. And so not knowing those, whenever you go not just to a foreign country, but to a local community, the rules are going to change. As an example, you know, Paula, if you're going to do short-term rentals, you better know what that city says about short-term rentals.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of restrictions now on short-term. So you better know those ahead of time. Don't go go buy a place thinking you're going to Airbnb it. And Airbnb then is out the window because the city won't let you do it.
Right. Yeah. There's a big difference with Airbnb, Phoenix versus Dallas. I mean,
yeah,
massive difference. There are a couple of pieces. First of all, Claudia, you said a flat in the Upper West Side for $160,000. I don't think that's right. There's nothing in the Upper West Side for $160,000. I don't know.
I'm not laughing, by the way. Just to be clear, as I'm laughing, I'm not laughing at Claudia,
right?
Because you can live in a different spot and right. not know what conditions are there. I'm laughing because that would be amazing, Claudia, in Manhattan,
right?
Either that or it would be really, really crappy.
Even something crappy you couldn't get for 160, right?
The well, 4 square feet by. Broom closet.
Yeah, a friend of mine sent me a listing on 88th Street in the Upper West Side. He just sent me that listing yesterday. And that one, and his comment was, he was like, oh, this is cheaper than I expected. And that one was around like $550,000. So yes, certainly, Claudia, I'll challenge the thing that you think you found. But beyond that, the bigger conversation is, how do you confidently buy property in an area that you don't know a lot about? And the answer really boils down to, you talk to the people who own there, you know, talk to the people who live there, talk to people who rent there also, talk to people who work there, talk to people who grew up there, talk to people who used to live there but moved away. Like, you need to talk to a lot of locals in order to get a really good sense of what the different neighborhoods are like, you know, the characteristics of all of these different places. And that's true whether you're buying from overseas or whether you are someone who lives in Boston, but you want to buy in Indianapolis, right? What do? You talk to locals.
This is the reason why many people, when they move to a new area, either internationally or inside of a country, mm-hmm. will rent for maybe 6 months first, so they get a feel for the different neighborhoods, for the flow of the city. Is this truly close to the places that I want to frequent? Is it far away? What are the problems going to be? What are the upsides? So I get a feel for the heartbeat.
Right. You know, when I first moved to Atlanta, I actually took that one step further. Rather than sign a one-year lease there right away, the first thing that I did was I found a sublet. I found a 3-month sublet because I didn't know anything about Atlanta. I didn't know any of the neighborhoods. And I was like, you know what? Before I even commit to where I want to be a renter, I first just want to find a sublet and spend 3 months in the sublet so that I can get to know the city during that time.
Well, that's some advice for Claudia then, Paula. If she's able to come and spend an extended period of time, maybe at least a month, if she's able to do that, we don't know her situation, but if she can, that would be wonderful.
And, you know, what strikes me is that there's two components to the scuttlebutt that Claudia is going to need to do. Part of it is learn about the different neighborhoods in New York and the different price points of different types of real estate here. But the other piece of it is, and then this is the piece that's specific to buying from overseas, the assumptions, and sometimes they are unconscious assumptions that you're not even aware of, but the assumptions about how contract law works, how taxes work, how financing works, how inheritance or property disputes or estate planning, the assumptions that you might have about all of those things get thrown out the window when you're buying in another country. And so, and what's tricky about that are the unknown unknowns, right? It might not occur to you that contract law works differently in the US than it does in Germany. And so what does that actually mean in terms of what you need to know? You know, what are the assumptions that you are holding that no longer translate?
You don't know what questions to ask.
Exactly. That's what makes it so much harder when you're buying in a foreign country. And so again, it comes down to talking to experts. Claudia, what I want you to do is find real estate agents, find real estate attorneys, find experts who specifically specialize in working with people who are based in Germany who want to buy in the United States, right? Because there are people who specialize in working with overseas homebuyers. So those are the ones you'll want to be talking to. Real estate attorneys specifically. you can get a good deal of information. Joe, would you ever have, when you were a financial planner, would you have clients who were based overseas who wanted to buy in the U.S. before they returned?
I experienced a lot of things, worked with many executives, but never had that. I helped one gentleman buy a business when he got here from Turkey. Within weeks, he was ready to buy a business, but never somebody from there. I see that on TV. I actually, it's funny, Claudia, when I heard you, I was thinking about some of the episodes of Million Dollar Listing New York that I've seen, where you have some Russian oligarch who wants to spend $32 million, you know, buying a place, which was why, you know, my thought was make sure you're also working with good real estate people. But again, time on the ground is really going to tell you whether you're working with somebody good or not. It's so difficult to pull those strings from afar. At the very least, having people you know and trust and who know you in that community ahead of time, I think is not even optional. It's necessary.
Right. You know, there must be Facebook groups or online groups of German immigrants who are now living in New York City. And so communicating with some of them and asking them who they recommend when it comes to real estate agents or real estate, you know, attorneys or insurance providers or other professionals who are part of the process, getting those recommendations from other Germans who are living here in the US who have done exactly what you're aiming to do. You know, they went through this same process themselves just a few years ago. What are their recommendations? And also, make sure that you ask them, what are the things that they didn't know that they, in hindsight, you know,
wish they knew.
Yeah. And talk to a lot of people, because if you only talk to one or two, you're going to get a small slice of perspective. The more people that you talk to, the wider that lens will expand. And the more people that you talk to, the more you're able to sift and sort through information and distinguish good advice from bad, good information from bad. Because that's the other piece of it, is how do you know enough to have judgment about what you are hearing? And that largely comes from quantity, right? Being able to discern quality starts with first exposing yourself to high quantity.
I think only through high quantity can you also start to sift out biases, which
right.
might not be intentional bad advice. Just one or two people will have biases toward, I really like this, I didn't like that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, biases, underlying assumptions, things of that nature. So it looks like, Claudia, you have a lot of internet sleuthing, Facebook grouping, message board messaging. You've got a lot of that ahead of you. But
and maybe a trip to Manhattan
right.
as well.
But before you do that, even Zoom calls, get on FaceTime with people. But I'm excited for you. It's a big adventure. And I think you're going to love New York. It's a wonderful city. So congrats, Claudia. Joe? We've done it again.
I can't believe it. And what I loved about today's questions, even though they ostensibly were about real estate, they were all really, truly, even for a bunch of people that aren't going to invest in real estate, Paula, they're really questions about how do you think about your thinking?
Right, exactly. Exactly. The framework of decision making. And that's what this show is really about. Like I like to tell people that this is truly a podcast about how to make better decisions disguised as a money show, right? This is truly a podcast about how to be a better thinker, a smarter thinker, a more critical, nuanced thinker. You know, this is a podcast about that cloaked in the topic of money.
It's also a podcast about Paula and I disagreeing from time to time. That's what it's about.
That's what people seem to enjoy the most. At least that's what I've heard.
They enjoy it at our expense. They're trying to break up our friendship, Paula. They're trying to break it up.
Oh, nothing could ever do that, Joe.
They can't do that. It will not happen.
Joe, where can people find you if they want to hear more of you?
You know, if they want to hear an interview with Dr. Seth Kaplan, which just obviously you can tell Paula, how many times Paula and I talk about the guests that we have on our shows quite often with each other. There are a few that really affect us. I remember we spoke with a guest on Afford Anything, Ken Honda, for a long, I think we might have spoke for 90 minutes about the Ken Honda appearance. You can see it in the YouTube videos on the Afford Anything channel, how much people enjoy Ken Honda like I did. But Dr. Seth Kaplan talking about fragile neighborhoods, that's on our Stacking Deeds real estate show. So come join me and our friend Crystal Hammond over on the Stacking Deeds podcast.
Excellent. Excellent. And I want to give a shout out to, I mean, to all of our listeners, but particularly for our listeners on Spotify. Spotify rolled out this new thing. It's like a Q&A at the end of every episode. It just says, what do you think of this episode?
We've been having fun with that. We've actually changed it a little bit. We've also put in polls in some of ours.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So if you are listening on Spotify, please drop a note. Let us know it on any given episode. Let us know what you think. And for everyone, if you're on Apple Podcasts, if you're on Spotify, you know, no matter what platform you're on, make sure that you're following the podcast and leave us a review, because the reviews are incredibly helpful in allowing us to build this show and attract fantastic guests. So, and big thanks to everyone who has already left us a review. Those are awesome.
Well, and I know there's people today listening too, Paula, that have friends that need some of the direction we gave. If you know somebody who needs that direction and they need better help thinking, just refer the show to them.
Exactly. And we have show notes. You can subscribe at affordanything.com/show notes. If there's ever anything that I need to communicate to this community, but there's just, you know, something I need to say quickly that I can't say in a podcast or that didn't fit the, you know, I'll put it there. So affordanything.com/show notes for a synopsis of all of our episodes, timestamps, and occasional communication from me about how you can improve your money and your life and be a better thinker, a smarter thinker. Well, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Paula Pant.
I'm Joe Saul-Sehy.
And we will catch you in the next episode. So thank you for the question, Lindy. And congrats on the huge equity in your rental property and on your past success as a flipper. What?
Just, I'm old enough to think of flipper as that dolphin that would go save kids that are drowning.
I had that thought pop into my head as soon as I said flipper too.
Congratulations, Lindy. Splash your tail, Lindy. Go get a flipper.